And it pains me to see other people flying with them, considering what their reputations are. And I would like to see some kind of liability ceiling at least put on those kinds of individuals, so that if someone inadvertently hops into a plane with somebody else, because he has to go somewhere real quickly, that could cause him a lot of problems. And the liability ceiling that Amendment number 2 proposes, I think, is probably sufficient to give the private aircraft owner some assurance that, in fact, his passengers are covered by some kind of insurance. And I speak in favor of the motion or the amendment.
Representative Clarkson.
Mr. Speaker, the member from Hillside made some comments that, well, maybe they don't directly relate to the amendment. I think what I heard was a serious misinterpretation of the effect of the bill, and since it may affect people's vote on this amendment, I want to make sure that if I heard him correctly, that he should be corrected. He indicated that he gave three examples, one where somebody mistakenly flies into bad weather or fails to maintain the aircraft or otherwise commits negligence, that this bill would not, quote, would not relieve him of liability. That's exactly what this bill does, is relieve someone from that kind of liability, someone that takes a step over the line, something that's careless, the deliberate flying into weather, the failure to maintain the aircraft, the performing of some other negligent act. That's exactly what would happen here, is that person would not be held responsible for that negligence. And if I misunderstood the member from Hillside, I assume he'll correct me, because that isn't what this, what he said isn't what this bill does.
Representative Hurlburt.
Well, thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd like to respond to the speaker from Bethel, and I just don't agree with him at all. In fact, if I was on the passenger end of his completely, I'd probably agree with him. But for a person that owns an aircraft and virtually goes all over the country and hardly ever goes without having some of your seats filled by people that are wanting to go along with you for whatever reason, certainly don't make any sense. I mean, I fly out there and virtually 90% of the time I have somebody with me that just wants to go because he wants to go, he's going in that direction or for whatever reason. And it's just the fact of the matter, you say, yeah, I guess you can go because of whatever reason that you're going down that way. I'm going that way, and you know, I'll just do you a favor. It just don't make sense under that situation that he should have a call on you. That's all I got to say.
Representative Vasquez?
Well, Mr. Speaker, this sort of reminds me of, I'm not sure whether it's a resolution or a bill that you introduced dealing with requiring liability insurance by motorists. Seems to me the same principle needs to be applied to driving an airplane, if that's what you want to call it.
Representative Abood?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. If the premiums were the same as for aircraft, it was an automobile on mandatory insurance, I'd go along with something like that. But you're talking about two different beasts altogether. And the only statement, other statement I'd like to make is that if this amendment goes on to this bill, I got a lot of buddies of mine, I'll never take hunting and fishing again in an aircraft, whether they'd like to go or not. It's neither here nor there. You're restricting those private pilots from taking anybody with them. You go at your own risk, and that's been the name of this game in this country for as long as I can remember. I ask the body to vote this amendment down.
Representative Miller.
Well, Mr. Speaker, if the previous speaker has been taking people out in the past, absent this legislation, I don't know what's changed if this amendment it goes on, whether the bill passes or not. But, Mr. Speaker, the point I want to make, and I want to make it again, in fact, is I'll ask the one of the proponents of the legislation, or perhaps the author of the legislation, point blank. If a pilot or an owner or an operator has insurance, has insurance and an accident occurs, is the author under the impression that the injured person or the widow of an injured person can sue for damages?
Representative Herbert?
Mr. Speaker, that's absolutely correct. He could, and he should, or he or her should, because of line 17. It says, caused by intoxication or gross negligence of the operator. In fact, that's the only reason why you should ever sue. It shouldn't be sued because of he took off and he, for some reason unbeknown to him, his engine quit, for instance, which can very well happen, and he's both hurt, and the pilot was hurt too. Who does he sue? The passenger? I mean, you take some chances in life, but you shouldn't take a chance on gross negligence or intoxication, and that's grounds to sue.
Representative Miller?
Mr. Speaker, I repeat the same circumstances. In our hypothetical, and it's not just a hypothetical, I'm sure lots of pilots, lots of owners and operators carry insurance. Under the situation we just described, the engine quits, it wasn't gross negligence, nobody was drunk, two people are injured, plane is covered by insurance, plenty of insurance, $1 million worth of insurance. The fact situation is that the pilot can apply to his insurance company because, you know, he's covered by the insurance company. But even though there's an insurance coverage on that airplane, the passenger is prohibited by this legislation from seeking damages. Absolutely prohibited. May not recover damages, even if he's insured. It just doesn't compute.
Representative Winty.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The only concern I had, I guess, in introducing an amendment, I didn't know it would have, you know, create this much debate. But on the other hand, I didn't know there were so many pilots in here either. The obvious impact, particularly for the representative that didn't want to take his friends hunting, if he's taking them now, it's unlimited. They could millions of dollars of liability if they choose to do so. And I guess the impact of what I'm proposing now is to limit that liability to something, I guess, at least more reasonable, and I don't agree with all the $1 million in settlements. But we aren't necessarily talking two different beasts. The beasts we're talking about are human beasts. And whether you're talking a life or an injury to that beast, I still think there's a responsibility on this floor to look out for the liability and responsibility of those who ride as well. I'm not trying to open up $1 million lawsuits against individuals, which is the situation now. I'm still trying to provide for some coverage and some incentive, if you will, for even more responsible actions on the behalf of the pilot. But the fact of the matter, if this bill passes and I own a plane and I have insurance, I'm going to cancel it. There's no reason for the insurance because I'm not going to have to pay anybody anything. I offered the amendment both on the constitutional grounds that was discussed thoroughly in committee, and secondly, to maintain the responsibility I feel the state has on protection of its citizens, yet at the same time recognizing the problem the sponsor has created and the need to limit that liability to some extent. But I don't consider the amendment unreasonable in any way, shape, or form.
Are you ready for the question? Question is, shall the House adopt Amendment Number 2 to House Bill 126? Members may proceed to vote. Has any member failed to vote? Clerk may lock the roll. Do any members wish to change their vote? Representative Malone. Representative Malone, from no to yes. Clerk, may take the roll.
14 yeas, 24 nays.
The House has failed to adopt Amendment Number 2. Does the clerk have further amendments?
No, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Barnes?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move and ask unanimous consent that House Bill 126 be engrossed, advanced to third reading, and placed on final passage.
Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Will the clerk please read House Bill 126, amended House, in third reading?
House Bill Number 126, amended by Hurlburt and Cowdery, an act limiting the liability of aircraft owners or operators for personal injury or death to guest passengers.
Is there debate? Representative Clarkson?
I have a question for the prime sponsor, Mr. Speaker. I already asked one hypothetical, and he answered that. Let me ask you another hypothetical, which is not that unusual, since it's a very common circumstance in automobile guest statutes. How about the passenger who does ask to be taken on a plane ride, who does not compensate the pilot, who once the flight begins makes a determination that the pilot is not safe and asks to be let out, asks to be that they turn around and return, or that they land at the closest field because he does not feel safe in the plane. Under those circumstances, if an accident later occurred because a pilot refused to cooperate with that request, would that pilot or would that passenger still be prohibited from recovery for negligence?
Representative Hurlburt.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. That particular incident happened to me, and I would certainly say that it could be argued in court that he was negligent. That would be a given, I would think.
Representative Abood.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The passenger at that point should take out his rosary.
Representative Clarkson.
Yeah, he ought to, because he's certainly not going to recover any money. The answer from the sponsor, of course, was that the pilot would be negligent. Under this legislation, there'd be no recovery because of that negligence. So the answer to the question, apparently, is that the passenger who takes off in the airplane, determines it's unsafe, protests, asks to be returned to the field, the request is ignored by the pilot, there is later an accident caused by the negligence of that pilot, that passenger is out of luck. That's what I understood the answer to be.
Representative Hurlburt.
Mr. Speaker, I have disagreed with that. If the legislation says that he would not, that a guest who rides aboard the aircraft may not recover damages unless the action was caused by intoxication or gross negligence. So under that situation, he could recover damages.
Representative Clarkson?
Well, that, I guess, gets to sort of my final argument on final passage. That's the distinction between negligence and gross negligence. The sponsor of the legislation has made that reference several times now. He said, for example, anything that, quote, inadvertently happens shouldn't hold the pilot, you shouldn't hold the pilot responsible for that. I agree with that. That's not negligence. That's inadvertent. Or he said, if the engine quits for a reason unbeknownst to him, being the pilot, that's not negligence either. So even under the existing law, the pilot in that case would not be responsible. The situations I'm concerned about are where there is evidence of negligence, but not of gross negligence. Gross negligence is a complicated concept, but it basically means the worst type of negligence. There is a whole broad variety of negligence that will be cut off, that the pilot who is negligent will be protected under this legislation. Even the pilot who is negligent and refuses to land the aircraft to let the passenger off who protests because the passenger feels that the pilot is not safe. Okay, well, let me make a couple of points. First of all, I think that we have established that there are at least a couple of categories of people, of passengers, who would not be allowed to recover for negligence that I'm not sure we ought to cut off from that liability. The first course, is the passenger who protests. If there is negligence, that person will never recover, despite the fact that they recognized the negligence and sought to protect themselves from it and were ignored by the pilot. That person will be foreclosed from this by this legislation from any recovery. The second one is the employee who is flying in a company airplane, who I would suspect doesn't have a heck of a lot of choice. If he wants to continue his work, he can either agree to go, or if he doesn't want to go because he thinks it's negligent, he runs the risk of losing his job. That person couldn't sue because of the negligence of the pilot if this legislation is adopted. Those are not your normal passengers, not your normal guests, and yet they're people that will be cut off from the ability to recover for the negligence of the pilot. Mr. Speaker, as you probably have gathered, I'm opposed to the legislation. I think that there are two important reasons for a liability provision that makes people liable for their negligence. The first, obviously, is to compensate the one who suffers because of that negligence, to pay their hospital bills, to pay their widow, to deal with the injuries, whatever. But the second reason, and this is real important, I think, with regard to pilots, although it applies to car drivers and everybody else, you know that if you're not careful, you're going to have to pay some money to somebody for your negligence. And if you remove the possible liability, you remove that incentive to be careful. Now, I know a lot of pilots, and we know what the safety record of pilots in Alaska is. There are many, many very competent pilots and some that aren't so competent. And Mr. Speaker, anything we do that reduces the incentive of a pilot to be careful is a bad idea. I know a lot of pilots that basically think they're immortal. So if they have to make the decision themselves about whether something is safe or not safe, they basically will think, I'm immortal. And so the next thing they'll think about, or that they ought to, is, geez, if I take that risk, if I don't check that airplane, or if I take that unnecessary risk of flying through some bad weather, if I take that one little step beyond, I'm going to be responsible for that passenger. And that's an incentive not to make that next step. Not to be irresponsible, because there's someone in the plane you're responsible for. If you eliminate liability, you eliminate that incentive to be responsible. Now, that's the same with automobiles, Mr. Speaker, and that gets me to my second point. This legislation, if adopted, would treat guests flying in airplanes differently from guests flying or driving in automobiles. Now, the response from the member from Spinard is the difference is the amount of premiums paid. Mr. Speaker, I submit that that's not a sufficient difference to allow a person who's killed by the negligence of a car driver to recover for that negligence, or the widow to recover, and the person who's killed by the negligence of an airplane pilot not to be able to recover. That distinction is unfair in my mind. It is not justified to treat automobiles and airplanes differently. And in fact, the Supreme Court of California agrees with that. It has struck down a statute almost identical to that one that we're dealing with here. And let me quote the reasoning from the Supreme Court of California. We conclude that the airplane guest statute is unconstitutional. The hospitality justification, and that's the one we've received for this legislation, that you want to be hospitable. The hospitality justification for denying recovery to a guest, first, does not explain the distinction drawn between airplane guests and other guests, meaning automobile guests, and secondly, does not constitute a rational ground for withdrawing the guest's right to recover for negligently inflicted injuries. So, Mr. Speaker, in summary, this legislation, I think, is going to encourage more risks to be taken by private pilots, and it is going to create a discrimination between the passengers in airplanes and the passengers in automobiles that is not fair.
Representative Pestinger.
I'm sorry, Mr. Speaker. It's still a jury question. The jury would receive an instruction on what gross negligence is. Gross negligence is more than ordinary negligence. It's a wanton disregard of the rights of others. The jury may find liability if they choose to find gross negligence. We're still trusting the jury with this important question. We're just changing the instructions that would be given to the jury. I think in response to the question from the other, from the representative from downtown Anchorage, I think an employee flying in a company airplane probably would not be a guest. I think there's a very good argument on that point. The final point on the unconstitutionality, that is something that you never can predict. It's very possible our Superior Court judge may strain for a different definition of gross negligence, and our Supreme Court may go in an entirely different direction. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Representative McBride.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I am not an attorney, and we do have a couple in the House, or maybe the sponsor of the bill could answer this, but it says that a guest may not recover damages from the owner or operator unless the operator of the airplane is either intoxicated or in gross negligence. I would like to ask the question that if the mechanic who repaired that airplane was in gross negligence, it would appear to me that that guest would not be able to collect. And would that be right?
Representative Hurlburt.
I think, Mr. Speaker, I'm not an attorney either, but I would assume that maybe you could go back and sue the mechanic. I'm not real sure. I know, I think we had a similar bill last year that dealt with that, that had to do with being able to go back and sue the refinery where gas resulted through a change of hands all the way up till it got in your airplane. So apparently that you can go back and sue an ultimate party way beyond the direct operator. So I would think that you could.
Representative Cowdery?
Yes, I would think that the, I think the rules of, you know, getting the pilot, being a pilot, the pilot is responsible. And that if he had a unqualified mechanic made an error, that probably would go through the pilot far as being responsible for it. However, I think in answer to the constitutional question and that the state of Oregon found this a similar piece of legislation constitutional. So I think that's a question. I think that the courts would have to decide, and I would ask the passage of this bill.
Representative Gall.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I have no false illusions that this point is going to change minds substantively on this issue, but I think the wording is rather clear. It says here that if there is gross negligence on the part of the operator of the aircraft, then there is liability to the owner. But that's the only circumstance under which there is liability to the owner. If the owner himself repairs the airplane or fuels it or maintains it and does a negligent or incompetent job, he is not subject to liability unless the operator is guilty of intoxication or gross negligence. I don't see any other way of interpreting this, and it seems to me clear that if an employee of the owner who is not the operator of the aircraft causes the failure of that aircraft, the owner and the operator are not liable.
Representative Winty.
Brief at ease.
Will the House please stand at ease?
Thank you for the time, Mr. Speaker. I guess my concern is clear in terms of addressing the concerns of the sponsor, but I think to clarify it, almost every example that's been brought up, and learning a little more and more about attorneys as I go, I think it's very clear, almost clear in the way that Representative Schultz talks about clear, that that every example that's been brought up in which negligence has been addressed, there would be no liability whatsoever if this bill should pass. That, in fact, when you're talking gross negligence, you're probably talking a very few cases in which any liability would remain with this legislation. In fact, almost disregard for human life or willful intended actions that lead to injury or death would be about all that would be considered under gross negligence. So I suggest that we go back to second reading to remove the word gross, so that liability would be placed when negligence was proven as opposed to gross negligence. Apparently the consensus of the sponsor and his attorneys are that go ahead and push the buttons and see where it may fall. I'm concerned. I guess we're going to go ahead and do that. But I guess I'm concerned for the injuries or widows that are going to befall us. And there's no question in terms of that's going to happen very soon, given the history of air safety in this state. And I guess all of us at some point in time are going to have to shoulder that responsibility as well.
Is there further debate? Representative Zaroff.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. It's not really a debate. Maybe it's an answer to a question, a hypothetical question that was brought forward earlier, and maybe one that I can maybe relate to a little bit more closely, I guess, than that, and that is that if I, as an individual, go up with a pilot just for a ride, and I find that all of a sudden that this is probably not the best person in the world to be flying with, and it proves out to be correct, and the end result, either the pilot survives or neither one of us survive, what recourse does my family have in regards to collecting anything in turn? If the pilot survives, according to this, he certainly isn't going to claim gross negligence on his part, but yet after my being involved with him and maybe flying with him for a short period of time, I find that he is not operating that plane in a safe manner, and afterwards he indicates that I went up on my own free will, of course, which I did to begin with. There is no recourse there that I can see then that would be left towards my family to proceed on it. I don't know if anybody wants to respond to that or not.
Representative Herbert.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd just like to note that if myself and Representative Zaroff took off at a Cessna 150, that'd be gross negligence.
Representative Representative Clarkson.
In a more serious vein, the answer to Representative Zaroff's question is, in fact, if there were no gross negligence, your family would not be able to recover for the negligence of that pilot.
Representative Miller.
Speaker, I strongly suspect, in fact, I'm very sure that under this, in the terms of this legislation and the lack of definition of intoxication or gross negligence, that a person could, that the pilot could be, you know, smoking grass at the time of an accident, and there could be no recovery of no opportunity for suing.
Are you ready for the question?
Question.
Question is, shall House Bill 126, amended House, pass the House? Members may proceed to vote. Has any member failed to vote? Clerk, may lock the roll. Do any members wish to change their vote? Representative Gall?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, from yes to no.
Representative Gall, from yes to no. Clerk, may take the roll.
24 yeas, 12 nays.
House Bill 126, amended House, has passed the House. Will the clerk please read the next item on today's calendar?
House Bill number 210 by Schultz, Duncan, and Liska. An act relating to payment for purchases by the state and providing for an effective date. The Committee on State Affairs is at House Bill 210 under consideration. Recommends it be replaced with committee substitute for House Bill 210 State Affairs with the same title and recommends it do pass and attaches a fiscal note. Report was signed by Mr. Abood, Chairman, concurred in by Abood, Furness, Cowdery, Schultz. M.M. Miller, finding no recommendation, Larson and Vasca. The Committee on Finance is at House Bill 210 under consideration. Recommends it be replaced with committee substitute for House Bill 210 Finance with the same title and recommends it do pass and attaches a zero fiscal note. The report was signed by Mr. Adams, Chairman, concurred in by Pestinger, Ward, Duncan, Grusendorf, Martin, Adams, and Bedesworth. Jaroff has no recommendation. I have two committee substitutes on my desk, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Barnes.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move and ask unanimous consent to committee substitute finance for House Bill 210 be adopted in lieu of the original bill.
Is there objection? Hearing none, the Finance Committee substitute is adopted in lieu of the original bill. Does the clerk have amendments?
No, Mr. Speaker.
Will the House please stand at ease? Clerk, Representative Zaroff?
Yes, Mr. Speaker. I think it might be appropriate at this time, after some very serious consideration on this piece of legislation, I would like to move and ask unanimous consent that my committee recommendation of no recommendation be changed to a do pass.
There is objection. Representative Miller, is that, I believe that's proper, is with unanimous consent. Can I get your opinion from the floor, please?
Yes, Speaker, that is correct. The member can ask to change his
recommendation. Without objection, Representative Zaroff's committee report will reflect a due pass.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Will the clerk please read the amendment number one to the Finance Committee substitute for House Bill 210.
Amendment number one by Mr. Adams. And it starts page 2, line 21. It has been duplicated, I hope, and placed on each member's desk.
Representative Adams.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Before I move this, amendment was moved unanimous in House Finance. It got dropped out. And at this time, Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent that amendment number one be adopted.
Is there objection? Hearing none, amendment number one is adopted. Does the clerk have further amendments?
No, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Barnes.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move and ask unanimous consent the committee substitute finance for House Bill 210 be considered engrossed, advanced to third reading, and placed on final pass.
Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Will the clerk please read the bill for the third time?
Committee substitute for House Bill number 210, finance amended by the Finance Committee. An act relating to payment for purchases by the state and providing for an effective date.
Is there debate?
Question.
Are you ready for the question? Question is, Representative Schultz, do you wish the floor?
If I may, please, Mr. Chairman.
You have the floor.
Or Mr. Speaker, I mean, sorry. I very seldom have the chance to stand up and say anything significant. And I would just appreciate it if I could give some reasons for this piece of legislation. first of all, and I went to quite an extent here to get this thing written down. The bill has been requested by various vendors throughout the state that have had problems with the state of Alaska. And I also wanted to point out to you the bill is patterned after a federal law entitled the Prompt Payment Act, which is Public Law 97-177. And that was became effective October 1st, 1982, when it was introduced into Congress, and at that time it had 133 sponsors. And also in checking with some of the military bases throughout the state, they come under that federal law, and they have said once they have complied with it, that their accounting procedures and everything else have become more routine, and it's very easy to pay in a very prompt manner. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Is there further debate? Are you ready for the question? Question is, shall the Finance Committee substitute for House Bill 210, amended House, pass the House? Members may proceed to vote. Has any member failed to vote? Clerk may lock the roll. Do any members wish to change their vote? Clerk may take the roll.
34 yeas, 2 nays.
The Finance Committee substitute for House Bill 210, amended House, has passed the House. Representative Barnes.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move and ask unanimous consent that the roll call vote on passage of Committee Substitute Finance for House Bill 210, amended, be considered the roll call vote on the effective date clause.
Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Will the clerk please read the next item on today's calendar?
House Bill number 308 by the Labor and Commerce Committee, an act relating to insurance. The Committee on Labor and Commerce has had House Bill 308 under consideration, recommends it be replaced with committee substitute for House Bill 308, Labor and Commerce, with the same title, reports it back with individual recommendations and a zero fiscal note. The report was signed by Mr. Furness, Chairman, signing Dupass, Furness, Ringsted, and Malone. Signing no recommendation, Wente, Kopanen, Ewling, and Cowdery. I have one committee substitute on my desk, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Barnes.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move and ask unanimous consent that committee substitute Labor and Commerce for House Bill 308 be adopted in lieu of the original bill.
Is there objection? Hearing none, the Labor and Commerce Committee substitute is adopted in lieu of the original bill. Does the clerk have amendments?
Yes, Mr. Speaker.
Will the clerk please read the first amendment?
Amendment number 1 by Mr. Martin. Page 1, line 8 through 14. Delete section 1. Renumber following sections accordingly.
Representative Martin.
Mr. Speaker, I move the amendment.
There is objection. Representative Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, this is a bill that we've had last year and the year before when I was the Chair of Labor and Commerce, and I feel that if the body doesn't mind, a long explanation is needed. I want to specifically direct your attention to Section 1 and read part of that sentence, which says the director may require carriers to participate in a signed risk pool as the director finds mandatory carriers and so on. The exception in here is of such nature that we'll very shortly see a situation in Alaska like we see in the nation with Social Security. Once the government has made a law that everyone should participate evenly, in those people who are probably more apt to suffer than others, then various government agencies and nonprofit agencies and other people get exemptions from themselves in participating, therefore making it very costly for those who are forced to participate because of others who passed a law chose not to participate. And so we see today Social Security in a bad situation. In this case here, the legislators in their wisdom years ago, through the Division of Insurance, said that all employers, public, nonprofit, private, will participate in the high-risk level employees and rather jobs that are available. In this case here, we see that the municipal governments and in one case, non-public utilities, non-profit utilities, will be excluded. And the problem here is that from our hearings last year, especially with the municipality of Anchorage, they were the worst, absolutely the worst offenders in taking back employees who previously were hurt or injured and anyone who filed a workers' compensation. They systematically exclude those people from being re-employed, no matter if they were retrained or what. And the idea there was strictly to keep your own insurance premium down. Now what we're allowing here is kind of a group insurance for the nonprofit public utilities, which is all right, and group insurance by municipal governments, which is all right too, except when you understand the experience with group insurance in the southern 48, we don't have too many up here in Alaska yet, although the division is promulgating laws. Matter of fact, I think they finished those and they passed them to allow group insurance. So maybe the fishing industry, the timber industry is a good example that's doing it now. The trucking industry may all combine and get one carrier to carry their premiums, and they would be able to have their own safety programs and hopefully work in such a way to reduce their premiums. But another way to reduce your premium is to refuse to accept those employers or employees or companies who are of a similar business. And if you know, if X in the taxi industry, they want to do this too as a group insurance, they know the two or three taxi company that caused all the accident, which caused the rates to go up for all of them. At the same time, they would like to pool their resources and have a group insurance, but they want to exclude those two or three companies that have the high risk factors. In this case here, we're talking about individuals. Who will pay for that individual who is considered for one reason or another at the high risk? And will this make it possible for companies, especially in municipal governments now, since they're going to combine it, and public utilities, nonprofit utilities, to discriminate against these individuals? I think that first, we must really reevaluate, and the commission is doing this, group insurance. And they should be allowed to give a couple years' experience to find out if this is going to be beneficial for the state and for its employees, not necessarily for the employers, but its employees. In this case here, where they may discriminate against a high-risk individual and keep their own premium rates and not have to participate in the statewide. They won't have to pay their pro rata share of statewide high-risk groups and or individuals, then they can exclude all the more to keep their premiums lower. And for smaller companies, and in this case here, the private employer is the one that's going to be suffering more and more in high premium because he is going to be forced to take in or at least pay for those high-risk groups. And I think that we're getting into a field right here that has not been explored enough to allow us to make a reasonable decision. Is the individual going to be hurt above the benefits of the state, or vice versa, municipal government over a private utility? And I know the chairman is ready to give other arguments on this, and I think as he brings his point of view up, I'll bring some more up. Thank you.
Representative Furness.
Mr. Speaker, to be honest about this, I'm trying to determine what the last speaker said. He spoke about taxi cabs, and I don't understand the relationship of this bill to taxi cabs. He speaks of individuals in high risk, and I don't understand that because the bill addresses reciprocal insurance, or, well, in fact, reciprocal companies formed by nonprofit utility companies and municipal own utility companies, so there's no relationship there. He speaks of, again, an individual who may not be able to get any kind of coverage, and that has nothing to do with Section 1 of the bill. That has to do with a second injury fund. To be frank, Mr. Speaker, I don't know what the gentleman is talking about. It has no relationship to Section 1 of this bill. Perhaps he could restate it more plainly that we can understand the logic of his objection, the amendment or whatever.
Be glad to, Mr. Speaker. I don't know how much work they've done then. It makes me wonder if the Labor and Commerce did sufficient amount of work on the bill. We do have documents that were presented to the body insurance industry and the National Insurance Association that explains very well what we mean there. If you didn't read it, sir, that's quite all right. We'll do it now. What it is that we're talking about the pro-rata responsibility of all employers helping with high-risk industry, jobs, or whatever. For instance, the timber industry is self-insured, but they still participate under the state's share of participating in the assigned risk pool. They still participate in that. I noticed you did make a change from the first bill to the second bill, which said the first bill almost excluded them from that responsibility, although the timber industry did it on a voluntary basis. Now, the only two that we're excluding is municipal government and nonprofit utilities. And I say that Anchorage area municipal government has been the worst one to systematically take high-risk individual, and what they call a high-risk individual is anyone who made a claim on workers' comp. They did their dead level best to make sure they weren't reemployed no matter how well they were retrained. Secondly, when we're talking about the second injury fund, this was something that the legislators did, I believe, last year, if not the year before, I stand corrected on that, but just recently. In order to encourage employers, whether it be municipal, state, or private, to re-employ people who were severely handicapped, who had, under workers' comp program, been retrained, in order to encourage them to re-employ these people, we pick up the second injury fund. And it has nothing to do with the assigned risk pool. When I talked about taxi, I said air taxi. The Air Taxi Association last year came to the Labor and Commerce. They wanted group insurance. And they did know the two or three carriers that made it almost prohibited for them, the other good air carriers, to get a decent premium. One way to do that is to go into a self-group insurance. And the division has done that now, but they have not allowed them to exclude high-risk groups or individuals. So what I'm saying here, like Social Security, if you make it equal for everybody, no one minds. They pay their fair share for that person that seriously needs covering. If you begin excluding individuals and expect others to pay the high-risk group, then a smaller and smaller group, in this case here, the private employer, because you're excluding, once you put in municipal governments, it's a large segment of the population that's going to be excluded, or an employer. The state even participates in this too. Why don't we put the state, exclude them from doing it? Then we're going to exclude all other nonprofit groups. I'm really afraid that once you do that, those people who have a high risk and those industries who have a high risk are going to be excluded from any availability in the state at all as far as getting insurance coverage.
Mr. Speaker, I think I understand the problem with the previous speaker's comments. He's interchanging people and companies to mean somewhat the same thing. Let me perhaps take the pleasure of informing this body what Section 1 really is. Section 1 sets up the ability of a municipality-owned public utility or a non-profit public utility to set up their own self-insured program for workers' compensation purposes. It also exempts those companies from what's called a participation in an assigned risk pool. Now, the assigned risk pool reads like this. It is more applicable to a profit company in that if there is a claim, let's say a company goes out of business and they are not able to handle any claims that an employee may have, what the industry will do is take that amount of claim and spread it out
over those insurers, at least those companies that are in the industry. For example, if there are 10 insurance companies that are participating and the amount is $1,000, each one of them will pay up $100. Mr. Speaker, under this particular proposal, the reciprocals formed by the municipalities and the nonprofit utility companies will not enjoy the benefit of this pro rata distribution. So it makes no sense that they in turn pay into it. It was generally felt that that provision is best served for a profit-making company, one that accepts business off the street. I would share with this body that in Section 1, the intent here is that a nonprofit public utility will only address and service other nonprofit public utilities. They would not service a construction company down the street or a plumbing company down the street. It would service only nonprofit public utilities and municipality. The bill provides that they would in turn join their funds together. Now, the other question that he's making, I believe he's talking about an individual who may be injured, and there may be some hesitation of another company to reemploy this person. Well, I would draw the member's attention to AS 2330-040. It provides that payments will be made. And Mr. Speaker, what happens in this sense, statute already says that whether a company is a self-insured or not, they still must contribute to the second injury fund. So if the previous speaker was trying to address a situation where an individual is injured and one needs to assure that this person is not penalized because of that injury, but then the second injury fund, of which all carriers, be they a self-insured carrier or a for-profit carrier, must still contribute to that. And that's what's confusing, because in his dissertation, he's confusing people and companies and using those terms interchangeably out of sync, and it's making it very confusing for this body to try to get some handle on what he's trying to say.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. By law, corporation, people, and all are the same one and the same thing. So we'll try to make it a little clearer. The gentleman is right. Section 1 does two things. One, it allows group insurance with municipal government and non-profit public utilities. And that's all right. I don't mind that at all. However, I do mind excluding them from participating in the pool for high risk and their fair share of the pro rata risk groups and or individuals. And I mean group and or individuals. We find out down in Louisiana, the trucking industry felt we got to do something in this state, Louisiana, so we'll go group insurance. We'll set up our own insurance program, we'll set up our own carrier, we'll set up our own training and safety program. That's where group insurance will even make it or break it, if they have a good training and safety program. In most cases, most of them, self-insured group insurance groups went busted when they did not have the privilege of kicking out that member who had the highest risk. In some cases, they tried to kick out that individual that had the highest risk. And once they did that, or if that person goes bankrupt, then they still assume the responsibility of all insurance debt of the member that went bankrupt. So there's a safety there for the individual, for the employee. That's number one. If they tried and failed because one member was really negligent, then at least they tried and we're allowing the freedom here. But to exclude them from the responsibility, and once they do that, you can bet your life systematically, as the city of Anchorage has a good history of doing, and I don't know about these nonprofit utility companies, they will systematically not rehire an individual once they've had a workers' comp claim, because that keeps down the risk factor. Someone else is going to have to pick it up somewhere along the line, that individual, and it doesn't help second injury funds. Second injury funds are those who we have trained in rehabilitation and tried to find employment with them, and practically have begged companies, and companies don't mind hiring these special people that have been rehabilitated. They did mind, though, that extra burden of carrying that higher premium, and that's what the state does, because we find it cheaper to carry that second insurance premium for them. And as you mentioned, all employers are participating in it, but the biggest one is the state participating in it. I think we need to separate the question. If you want it to pass in Section 1, yes, allow group insurance for municipality and or nonprofit utilities, but don't exclude them at the same time from participating in the pro-rata high-risk groups and individuals.
Representative Furness.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The previous speaker would lead one to believe that this is something new. I would share with this body that present statute does permit municipal-owned utilities to form their reciprocal and set up their own program. That's been in statute for some time. Secondly, Mr. Speaker, the nonprofit utility companies was granted a right to form their own insurance company some 3 years ago. It has only been, excuse me, in a matter of, I guess, 6 months or so, that a determination was made that authority was given illegal. Now, the previous speaker was chairman of Labor and Commerce last year. I'm sure he's aware that there is no evidence to support that the nonprofit public utilities cannot handle this responsibility. I'm sure he is aware that they're required to carry upwards of $250,000 in ready cash reserve, quick access reserves, in addition to certain bonding. I'm sure he's aware that they also go into the open market to Lloyd's of London and whatever larger companies to buy additional insurance. This is nothing new. They've been doing it for 3 years. There's no evidence that there's any bad experience with it. What this piece of legislation does is clear up what could be classified as a gray area in the statute. And the last point here, Mr. Speaker, it does not make sense to include these reciprocal insurers in the pool when they cannot draw from that particular pool. What they would indeed be doing is paying into something that they get no benefit from. The truth of the matter is that there has not been an assessment under the assigned risk pool for the last 3 to 5 years. No one has paid any monies into the pool or received any monies out of the pool, because of the good history in the state of Alaska. Mr. Speaker, from testimony that we heard in committee, no one is anticipated to pay any monies or receiving a benefit from this assigned risk pool for several years to come. It simply does not make sense to put them under something that, again, they get absolutely no benefit from.
Representative Martin.
Well, I think we're playing with terms here. The assigned risk group is shared by everyone, every employer in the state, public and private, and nonprofit, since we have a large segment of those. Your claim loss is a completely different situation. Yes, people can go to Lloyd's of London, they can go to Chinatown and get a second mortgage coverage, insurance coverage, which is all right. There's no problem with that. It's like you and I may do for our home. We have the first mortgage, and then we have the second mortgage. So we pay the one off before the other in order to have be able to buy the product in most cases. In this case here, too, people will go to one insurance carrier and be covered to a certain level, say maybe of $200,000 per claim. Then they can back that policy up by another major policy with a international or a major national group and get a second coverage for major, larger claims of $1 million or $2 million. Nothing wrong with that at all. And we should distinguish between the losses of those type of claims and the premiums paid from the assigned risk. In this state of Alaska, we're doing very well by making sure that every employee and all companies have a responsibility to those individuals and or companies that have a higher risk factor because of the nature of their jobs. And all insurance companies carriers especially, have agreed to that. Municipal governments have agreed to that. Now, if they can get out of it, like Social Security, why not? Last year in the committee, we chose not to pass such legislation because we thought it would start a trend. And you may notice that you talk about starting a trend. Well, you didn't start it, I said. In the first bill, we just had the municipal governments being exempt. Now, in the second bill, we see where the nonprofit utilities did get into it. Then next year, you're going to find more nonprofit companies getting into it. And not only municipality, why shouldn't a state get into it? We would save a lot of money. But who is responsible for the citizens? That's where the major factor belongs. And what industries and what jobs will be prohibited in this state because we do not have within our insurance division, we do now, but this will exempt it, a pro rata share of high-risk groups and or individuals.
Are you ready for the question? Question is, shall the House adopt Amendment Number 1 to the Labor and Commerce Committee substitute for House Bill 308? Members may proceed to vote. Has any member failed to vote? Clerk, may lock the roll. Do any members wish to change their vote?
Speaker.
Representative Adams?
Yes to no.
Representative Adams from yes to no. Clerk, may take the roll.
3 ayes, 31 nays.
House has failed to adopt Amendment Number 1. Does the clerk have further amendments?
No, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Barnes?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move and ask unanimous consent that committee substitute Labor and Commerce for House Bill 308 be considered engrossed, advanced to third reading, and placed on final pass.
Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Will the clerk please read the bill for the third time?
Committee substitute for House Bill Number 308, Labor and Commerce, by the Labor and Commerce Committee, an act relating to insurance.
Is there debate? Are you ready for the question? Question is, shall the Labor and Commerce Committee substitute for House Bill 308 pass the House? Members may proceed to vote. Has any member failed to vote? Clerk, may lock the roll. Do any members wish to